What's up, everyone, and welcome back to episode 4 of Law Between the Lines, a podcast that teaches you your rights and explores landmark Supreme Court cases and their impact today. Today, I have a very special guest with me in the studio, Maggie Goodlander. Yay!
Thank you, Sumana. It's so good to be here.
Thank you so much for coming. I'm really hyped you're here. Maggie Goodlander is the Democratic candidate for U.S. House of Representatives, and she has quite the history of qualifications. She served as a law clerk for Chief Judge Merrick Garland, Supreme Court Justice Stephen Breyer, taught constitutional law at both Dartmouth and UNH, served as an intelligence officer in the U.S. Navy Reserve, as a Deputy Assistant Attorney General in the U.S. Department of Justice, lawyer in the fight for voting rights with the NH Campaign for Voting Rights, and on the boards of NH Legal Assistance, the New Hampshire Campaign for Legal Services, the New Hampshire Women's Foundation, the New Hampshire's World Affairs Council, and the Warren B. Redman Center at UNH School of Law. I'm so excited to have you here, and thank you so much for making the time to come on my podcast.
Well, thank you for having me, and thank you for doing this podcast.
My very first question for you is, why are you running for U.S. Congress?
You know, I believe deeply in our government, and part of what brings me to this race, Sumana, is last year I was 20 weeks pregnant, and, you know, my husband Jake and I really want to become parents, and I was 20 weeks pregnant, and we lost our son, and it was the hardest thing that's ever happened to me. But I was so lucky in so many ways. I got access to the health care I needed, but because of the Supreme Court's decision in Dobbs, which ripped away a fundamental freedom for women across this country, we've seen massive backlogs, and I struggled to access the health care I needed. I ultimately got it, but I was left to manage a stillbirth on my own. And, you know, I honestly don't know if I would be in this race today if that hadn't happened to me, because I would be the parent of a one-year-old, a 13-month-year-old. But I'm in this race because I want to fight for freedom. We're the live free or die state, but we are the only state, New Hampshire is the only state in New England without any legal protections for abortion access. A 15-day abortion ban was introduced in our state house earlier this year, and Planned Parenthood has been defunded in the state. And look, Planned Parenthood is an organization that provides a full range of health care services to women in this country. When I was in the United States Navy, it's where I went to get a series of scans that I needed to get just to fulfill my medical obligations in the Navy. So it's a really, we're in such a profound moment in our country's history where when I think about what it's going to take to restore reproductive freedom in this country, that fight starts in the United States House of Representatives. It starts in the Congress. And so it would be the honor of my lifetime to represent the live free or die state in the People's House.
First of all, I would just like to say I'm so sorry for your loss, Maggie. I'm so sorry that happened to you. Thank you so much for running for U.S. House of Reps and for fighting for this fundamental freedom. It's an incredibly important right, and to suddenly have a sudden lack of access to reproductive health care is going to be extremely detrimental to the well-being of millions of women nationally. So thank you so much for what you're doing, and best of luck with the rest of your campaign.
Thank you. Can I just say something on that? You know, I've met so many women on the campaign trail of all ages. You know, I was speaking to a woman the other day. She's 82 years old, and so many women have stories. So many women have felt the pain that I've felt, who felt the loss that I've felt, and who have found ways to turn their pain into purpose. And so it's been, for me, just a truly energizing and optimistic experience to be a candidate for Congress in the state. Thank you.
I'm really glad you're running for Congress, Maggie, and thank you so much for your answer. I'm really happy to have you here today. So in today's episode, we're going to be talking a lot about the 14th Amendment, the right to privacy, and specifically covering the landmark cases on reproductive freedom, such as Roe v. Wade and Dobbs v. Jackson. And since Maggie has had such considerable experience in the Supreme Court, she actually might be able to explain a couple of constitutional law concepts and really help us understand the significant impact of these cases, especially since it's such a salient issue today. Knowing your rights, especially your right to privacy, is critical. So without further ado, let's jump into today's episode. So before we start directly discussing the 14th Amendment, we have to distinguish what is a civil liberty and what is a civil right. So civil liberties are basically individual protections against unjust government actions, functions, and interference, whereas civil rights actually protect classes of people from unjust government actions, and that's why we have things like the Civil Rights Amendments. So it's really important to know the difference between these two, because they are kind of how laws in the Constitution are classified. So the 14th Amendment is part of the civil rights legislation. It's a civil rights amendment. And the 14th Amendment is a pretty long one. It's got multiple different sections, so I'm just going to provide you with a quick summary of what each section entails. Section 1 of the 14th Amendment has three really important clauses. It has the Privileges and Immunities Clause, the Due Process Clause, and the Equal Protection Clause. So the Privileges and Immunities Clause basically says the equal protection of the laws is guaranteed in every U.S. state and every U.S. territory. The Due Process Clause says that you are no government action can be taken against you without due process of law, and that's very procedural. And then you have the Equal Protection Clause, which basically says that every citizen is entitled to the equal protection of the laws. Section 2 of the 14th Amendment says that representatives are apportioned to each state based on the state's population. Section 3 of the 14th Amendment says that no person can hold federal office or actually be an elector, like for the Electoral College, if they have engaged in insurrection against the federal government. You also cannot vote if you have engaged in insurrection against the federal government. That's what the being elector refers to. And this is Section 3 of the 14th Amendment also has this thing called the Insurrection Clause, which is what I just read out to you. Section 4 of the 14th Amendment says the validity of the national debt cannot be questioned by any outside sources, and it also says the United States will not pay the debt that is incurred in aid of insurrection or rebellion against the U.S., or in the U.S. will also not claim for the loss or the emancipation or of any slave. And Section 5 of the 14th Amendment says that Congress has the power to enforce any appropriate legislation in regards to this amendment. So there's a lot of issues that arise with this amendment, specifically with the Privileges and Immunities Clause, Due Process Clause, and Equal Protection Clause. And today, the right to privacy, which includes a woman's right to an abortion, or not right to an abortion as we saw in Dobbs v. Jackson, is actually included in the Due Process Clause of the 14th Amendment. This right to privacy is in the 14th Amendment. So before we talk about the depth of the Supreme Court cases we're going to cover today, it's really important to learn about this one thing called selective incorporation. And you may have heard me talk about this when we talked about McDonald v. Chicago a couple of weeks ago. So selective incorporation is basically when the Supreme Court applies certain rights from the Bill of Rights to the states on a case-by-case basis. So like how the right to owning a gun as established in McDonald v. Chicago, that was applied to the states through the doctrine of selective incorporation. So the selective incorporation is applied to the states through the Equal Protection Clause. So I actually have a question for you, Maggie. So how does selective incorporation actually work in the 14th Amendment? But more specifically, how does it allow Supreme Court rulings to be incorporated into the states, especially those dealing with rights not explicitly enumerated in the Constitution, like the right to privacy? Because selective incorporation, we've seen that work with the Bill of Rights like pretty frequently and a lot of the Civil Rights Amendments. But since the Supreme Court decisions aren't technically a law as mm-hmm. Congress has passed, how does that work?
Yeah, you know, this is where I do think when I've taught incorporation doctrine, this is an area where I do actually really believe the more interpreters of the Constitution we have, the better, because to give any, you know, to give nine people, or actually in most cases it's, you know, 5 to 6 people, a monopoly on how we interpret our Constitution is not a good thing for constitutional law. And so I'm really glad you're asking about this. And I really hope, Sumana, that you are going to be a constitutional lawyer, because we need you.
Thank you. Okie dokie, guys. Let's really jump into the bulk of today's episode, where we explore landmark Supreme Court cases directly connected to the 14th Amendment. The first case we're going to talk about is likely one that you've heard of before. It's Roe v. Wade. It's the case that guaranteed a woman's right to an abortion and protected it under the right to privacy in the Constitution. So in this case, there was a Texas law that only allowed abortions in cases where it would save the life of a mother. There was this woman, her name was Norma McCorvey, and she struggled heavily with addiction to drugs and addiction to alcohol, and she had two children previously, and she actually gave up her two children because she was just not fit to take care of them. And she was pregnant with her third child. She did not want to have this baby, so she falsely claimed rape within the courts in order to obtain access to an abortion. Obviously, this attempt in court failed, and she reappealed and filed claims under an alias, Jane Roe, to the Supreme Court. And basically what she said, like not being able to obtain an abortion, her right to privacy was violated. And we'll talk a little bit more about the right to privacy when we discuss this case called Griswold v. Connecticut, which actually gave the right to privacy. And basically what she said, the Texas state law was unconstitutionally vague. She said her personal privacy, her right to privacy, was protected by the First, Fourth, Fifth, and Ninth Amendments. And she filed this case against Henry Wade, who was the district attorney of Dallas County, Texas. So the constitutional question that this case raises is, does the U.S. Constitution protect the right of a woman to obtain an abortion? Now let's look at the arguments for both sides of this case. The arguments for Roe, aka Norma McCorvey, said that a woman's right to privacy is implicitly guaranteed in the First, Fourth, Fifth, Ninth, and Fourteenth Amendments. And this was established by the precedent of Griswold v. Connecticut, the landmark case that included the constitutional right to privacy. So basically what happened in this case, Griswold v. Connecticut, was like back in 1879, Connecticut passed this law banning the use of drugs and medical devices, any instruments that are used to allow contraception. And this law was passed in 1879, and this case was argued in 1965. So there was quite a bit of time that had passed before this had been argued. And this law regarding contraception was rarely enforced. And fast forward to 1965, there is this woman named Estelle Griswold, and she is the head of the Planned Parenthood chapter in Connecticut, and she opens a birth control clinic with a gynecologist. So she and this gynecologist were arrested, and they were said to have violated the Connecticut law. And so what they did was they challenged the Connecticut statute against contraception and said that their 14th Amendment rights were being violated. And this was under the Equal Protection Clause and the Due Process Clause that they challenged the Connecticut statute. So the constitutional question that Griswold v. Connecticut raised was, does the Constitution protect the right of marital privacy against state restrictions on a couple's ability to be counseled in use of contraceptives? So I actually have a question for you right here, Maggie. The Ninth Amendment says that the rights not specifically mentioned in the Constitution belong to the people. The right to privacy is actually one of those rights, and it's not explicitly enumerated in the Constitution. But instead of being protected under the Ninth Amendment, it's actually protected under the 14th Amendment Due Process Clause, which says that people cannot be deprived of life, liberty, or property without due process of law. How come the right to privacy is protected under the 14th Amendment's due process instead of the Ninth Amendment?
Well, you know, there are Supreme Court decisions that suggest that the Ninth Amendment, and it is one of the, it's sometimes the forgotten amendment, but it's a really powerful one, and it's a controversial one too these days. But look, my own view is that we've got protections to the right to privacy that appear elsewhere in the Constitution too. You know, we have a Fourth Amendment that guarantees some rock-solid protections towards privacy. Same with the Fifth Amendment and the 14th Amendment, too. But one of the things that I believe about the Constitution as you read it, amendments and provisions work together. And in the area of the 14th Amendment case law, we've seen that more clearly than perhaps any other area of constitutional law.
Thank you so much for clarifying that for us, Maggie. Now, guys, let's get right back to this case, Griswold v. Connecticut. So the main argument for this case is that that the right to privacy is one of the indirectly protected constitutional rights. And so, like Maggie just said, The Supreme Court decided that the right to privacy was inferred from several rights, like Maggie mentioned, the First Amendment, Third Amendment, Fourth Amendment, and Ninth Amendment, and all of those together combined created the implicit right to privacy. And so because this statute, this Connecticut statute, was specifically challenged under the 14th Amendment, the right to privacy was also guaranteed under the 14th Amendment, because that was in relation to the constitutional question that was raised. Okay, so now that we have that precedent established, let's get right back to Roe v. Wade. So let's continue with the arguments for Roe. Additionally, what Norma McCorvey said, aka Roe, was that unwanted pregnancies like hers could change a woman's life. And we have to look at this issue contextually. Like, I mean, the 1960s, it wasn't a super progressive time for women. I mean, sexism was still extremely blatant and very present. So women didn't really have as much support in the workplace either. Unwanted pregnancies could result in a woman being asked to leave her job. There wasn't really any maternity leave that would be provided. It could endanger her future entirely, could cause serious financial challenges, and it could be extremely damaging to a woman, both physically and psychologically. Furthermore, Roe also said that women have to travel like over state borders in order to receive proper reproductive health care, to receive abortion access, or if they don't have that proper access in the state or don't have the resources to go outside of the state, they have to undergo illegal abortions, and those pose an even more serious health risk. So having a medical procedure such as this, which can provide life-saving care, criminalized, or having such a vague verbiage of it that doctors are unsure under the premises under which they must operate, this is detrimental to the well-being of women across the state. And that is what Roe said. Roe further elaborated, saying that an unborn fetus is not legally recognized by the Constitution as a person. It has never been recognized by the Constitution as a person. So an unborn fetus should not have the same rights as a mother who is carrying the child. Now let's take a look at the arguments for Wade. So what they said is there was no specific right to an abortion that is guaranteed in the Constitution. They also said that a fetus is actually considered a person and that they should have constitutional rights. And the state has a vested interest in protecting the lives of their future citizens. And by that standard, abortion should be unconstitutional. Furthermore, they said an unborn child's rights are superior to that of the mother's rights. And so the unborn child's interests should be held above the mother's interests. They also said that marital privacy, or the individual right to privacy, is not an absolute right. And that you could see, and that is written in the dissenting opinion of Griswold v. Connecticut. They also said that the state of Texas wants to protect all life, and also they also care about women's health, which is why abortions are legalized only if it's in cases of saving the life of the mother, and that by that standard, the law is actually reasonable. And lastly, they said that abortion is not the same thing as contraception, so therefore the precedent of Griswold v. Connecticut doesn't apply here, and abortion should be a state issue. So if you remember what I said about the Ninth Amendment just a few minutes ago, powers that are not reserved to the federal government are actually delegated to the states, and since abortion, the right to privacy, isn't directly explicitly mentioned in the Constitution, so therefore the state of Texas has reasonable grounds for enforcing its laws. However, when the Supreme Court reviewed this decision, they actually decided 7-2 in favor of Jane Roe and said that the right to an abortion is included in the right to privacy, which is in the Due Process Clause of the 14th Amendment. The Due Process Clause protects against state action against the right to privacy. So the right to privacy under due process, that is established in the case Griswold v. Connecticut. They also said that only once a fetus reaches a point of viability may states regulate or prohibit abortions, as long as exceptions exist for life-saving care for the mother. So here you can really see how monumental this abortion case was, especially in the 1970s. This created so many more protections for women nationally. It provided them with proper access to reproductive health care, and it imposed restrictions on the states for creating their abortion laws and allowed women more freedom, especially within that first trimester of pregnancy, to terminate the pregnancy if they didn't feel comfortable with it and they felt like it wasn't the best decision for them. It provided them with more autonomy over their own bodies. So we're going to move on to our next case, and this is Women's Health v. Hellerstedt. And this is actually a pretty important case, especially to this topic, because its decision was kind of based on the reasoning behind Roe v. Wade. It was based on that precedent. However, as we know, Roe v. Wade was overturned by the recent Supreme Court case Dobbs v. Jackson. But this case, Women's Health v. Hellerstedt, still remained in effect even though Roe v. Wade was overturned. We're going to take a closer look at the details of this case and what exactly happened. Ironically enough, this case is also with the Texas abortion statute. In 2013, Texas passes a House bill, which has provisions regarding restrictions for abortion. So two of the provisions that were challenged in the court of law was that a physician performing abortion must be able to also admit patients at a hospital within 30 miles of wherever the abortion is performed. And additionally, it says all abortion clinics are required to use the same standards as ambulatory surgery centers. These abortion providers want to invalidate those provisions because they firstly said that it denies them equal protection of the laws. They said it was arbitrary and unreasonable state action. But what happened is the district court actually granted declaratory and injunctive relief against the enforcement of these abortion provisions. And if you don't remember what declaratory and injunctive relief is, essentially declaratory relief is when the plaintiff receives a judgment from the court that declares like the rights, actions, or duties or obligations from one or more parties. It just kind of defines them. And basically what this is to prevent the accrual of any avoidable damages. And injunctive relief is a court order that prevents a party from taking a specific action. But what actually happened was the abortion clinic's claims were dismissed by the district courts, and it said that they failed to show a substantial burden of law that was blocking a woman's path to an abortion. Before we continue with this episode, let's hear a quick PSA from the American Red Cross. In times of crisis, the American Red Cross is there for the men and women of the United States Armed Forces and their families. From communicating messages during emergencies to outreach to the National Guard and Reserves to veterans assistance and military hospital visits, the Red Cross provides vital services. Support the Red Cross service to the Armed Forces and change a life, starting with your own. To find out how you can help, visit www.redcross.org or contact your local American Red Cross chapter. Thank you. All right, now without further ado, let's get right back to this episode. So in reviewing this case, the Supreme Court used this thing called the substantial burden test. And basically, it identifies like a legal or regulatory obstacle that presents a challenge to enter a lawful profession. And based on the precedent from Roe v. Wade, which said that a woman's right to an abortion is a constitutional freedom provided under the right to privacy, the Texas law restricts a woman's constitutional right to an abortion. And they said the law is unconstitutional and it imposes undue burden. An undue burden is something that makes it way too difficult to obtain a fundamental right, which is exactly what the Texas law did. They said that the Texas's law procedures were too closely related to the actual procedures for abortion, and that's what posed the undue burden. Furthermore, if the Texas regulations from their House bill take effect, only about 7 to 8 abortion facilities would actually be able to function in the state. So it really is limiting the lack of care that women would have access to. In the concurring opinion, Ruth Bader Ginsburg actually wrote that modern abortions are safe. So the laws that surrounded that increased difficulty with accessing the abortion will not ever be able to pass judicial review. They will never be considered constitutional. So this case was made on a 5-3 decision. And it reinforced the precedent established in Roe v. Wade. And if you read any of the concurring opinions, you'll see that this fundamental right is repeatedly mentioned. So I actually have another question for you, Maggie. In Women's Health v. Hellerstedt, where the standard of a woman's right to an abortion was protected under the right to privacy based on the precedent established by Roe v. Wade and Planned Parenthood v. Casey, how come the Dobbs decision, which overturned Roe v. Wade and Planned Parenthood v. Casey, didn't also overturn Women's Health v. Hellerstedt? Because the same precedent was upheld based on a former case that was overturned. So how does that decision work, and why is that case still relevant today?
You know, the Dobbs decision, and I encourage all of your listeners to read it because it is the majority opinion in that case. It introduces a truly novel and I think radical standard for how we should read the 14th Amendment to the Constitution. And it sets out a framework that I think really puts at risk a lot of constitutional rights that have been recognized by the United States Supreme Court and protected by our Constitution. It's a framework that really requires looking backwards at history, and history from long ago, and that really erases so much of modern American history and constitutional law. And, you know, I come to constitutional law as a person who believes that the Supreme Court does not have a monopoly on interpreting the Constitution, that actually each branch of the government and citizens themselves have a real responsibility to read and to interpret and, where appropriate, to enforce the Constitution. And we all have our different roles to play, but this is a decision that, you know, I've taught before, and one that I think your listeners should take a hard look at, because the Dobbs decision introduces a truly novel and radical standard for how to interpret our 14th Amendment.
Thank you so much for your answer, Maggie. Actually, speaking of Dobbs v. Jackson, that's actually the next case that we're going to cover. So let's take a closer look at what happened in Dobbs v. Jackson. In Dobbs v. Jackson, there was this law that was passed. It was called the Mississippi Gestational Age Act, and this prevented all abortions with very little exceptions after the 15-week gestational period. And this law, by the precedent of Roe v. Wade that was previously established, should have been unconstitutional because it prevented abortions like before viability of the fetus. And so Jackson Women's Health Organization, which was the only licensed abortion facility in Mississippi, actually filed a lawsuit to the federal district court, and they requested an emergency temporary restraining order, otherwise known as a TRO. And the TRO prevents any actions from being taken for a certain period of time, and the district court actually guarantees Jackson Women's Health Organization a TRO. And this abortion clinic further requested for a summary judgment by the court. And if you don't remember from the last couple of episodes, a summary judgment is a judgment that is given to a party against another party without a trial. After this judgment is created, the Supreme Court precedent from Roe v. Wade, by that reasoning, it prevents states from banning abortions before viability, like I previously said. And then Dobbs brought this case, disputed the ruling, and brought it to the Supreme Court, and raised the constitutional question of, is the Mississippi law of banning abortions after the 15-week gestational age unconstitutional? As many of you may know and maybe familiar with this case, the Dobbs decision unfortunately resulted in more restrictions regarding abortion and reproductive health care. And it unfortunately overturned the precedent established by Roe v. Wade, which said that the right to an abortion is included in the constitutional right to privacy. The reasoning for this in the opinion of the court was that the Constitution doesn't actually mention abortion, and it didn't really fit the test determining how to overturn a precedent. So one of the key elements of the Supreme Court when they decide whether or not they're going to overturn a precedent is that there is grounding constitutionally in the text, or there's historical grounding for an issue to be overturned. Unfortunately, they said that their right to an abortion, this included in this right to privacy, does not have historical grounding and therefore violates that section of the test for determining whether or not a precedent is upheld. So I actually have another question for you, Maggie. So you were actually employed in the Justice Department during the time of this monumental decision. What was the atmosphere like, and what work did you do to help further reproductive freedoms for women?
Well, you know, when I was a law clerk on the Supreme Court from 2017 until 2018, what they call OT17, so October term starting in 2017. And honestly, you know, I don't think it came, I think we all understood that the Supreme Court's decision in Roe v. Wade was at serious risk. You know, we had a number of cases that had come up over the years. You know, the year I clerked, there was a case about what are called so-called crisis pregnancy centers, which are not healthcare providers. The opposite of that. We see these rising up all around New Hampshire. And the case that was at issue the year I was clerking on the Supreme Court was a California law called the FACT Act, which was simply doing some very simple and straightforward things, requiring people at these sorts of centers to disclose that they were not medical healthcare providers. And this law was struck down on First Amendment grounds. And to me, you know, this is one example of a decision that really raised the alarm bells on the fate of the ultimate protector of reproductive freedom, which was the Supreme Court's decision in Roe v. Wade. So, you know, the day that the Dobbs decision came down overruling the Supreme Court's decision in Roe v. Wade, I was at the Justice Department. We were standing up a reproductive rights task force dedicated to two really simple propositions: that women in this country should get access to the health care that they need, and doctors in this country should be able to provide that care without fear of prosecution. And the consequences of this decision have been that, you know, chaos ensued, injustice ensued. Women have struggled to get access to health care. They've been denied access to care. In some cases, it's resulted in death, and we know this. And doctors have not been free to provide care without fear of prosecution. So we know what the consequences are, and in the first policy agenda that we launched in this campaign was a reproductive freedom agenda, which starts with the very basic set of ideas that we should protect the rights that for so long we had relied on Supreme Court decisions to protect. The right to access abortion, the right to access contraception, which is something that's now been called into question, you know, the right to access IVF healthcare. The decision of if, when, and how to become a parent is one of the most, these are challenging questions. These are questions that go to the core, they go to core healthcare decisions, and there's no other area of the law where judges or politicians get in between people and their healthcare providers in making these decisions. And the Supreme Court unleashed what has been true injustice for women all across this country.
Thank you so much, Maggie, for your incredible, well thought out answers. It has been an absolute honor to have you on this podcast and to meet you at these town halls and the primaries and just get to know you. I mean, a college student running a podcast and having you, a candidate for U.S. House, that is incredible to me, and I'm so grateful for your time. I'm really glad that you're running for Congress. You definitely have my vote.
Well, thank you, and I would love to come back anytime, and I am genuinely grateful that you're doing this, because I wish that I'd had this podcast to listen to when I was in college.
Thank you so much, Maggie. And thank you so much for you guys for listening to this podcast. Next week, we're going to be covering more about the Fourth and Fifth Amendments, and we're going to talk about criminal rights. So thank you so much for listening, and I'll see you all next time. Bye.